morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Exactly 100 years ago today, a Tennessee public school teacher named John Scopes taught his public school class about evolution theory, which was a subject that was against state law at the time. The resulting Scopes monkey trial rocked the nation and ultimately helped redefine humanity's history of itself. Although most of its religions, still a century later, do not abide with reality nor our kinship with fellow simians. And now I wish to once again repeat an article I wrote for the North Coast Times Eagle, a rather radical rag I revived from a three-year crypt in the last third of the 20th century and continued into the first decade of this new millennium, still a baby at 25 years. Return of the New World Order. The 21st century is not the American century, despite the aspirations of the corporate imperialists who have usurped virtually absolute power in the USA. The business of America is business. The president mimics an earlier president, the usually terse Coolidge, but his ambitions parallel an even earlier Republican president, the first Roosevelt, who initiated the real American century, a century and more ago. America was not founded to make money, Woodrow Wilson complained in 1919. It was founded to lead the world on the way to liberty. Political liberty, he said, is the right of those who are governed to adjust government to their own needs and interests. The USA is not a business or a corporation. It is a society, and that is very different with clearly dissimilar needs and responsibilities. It is a democracy in design, which is contrary to the administrative elitism of a corporate entity. The real purpose of the American experience is that human beings are capable of coexisting as equals, that so-called free competition is not one of unfair or dominating advantage, nor is a democracy healthy when enormous numbers of its citizens are unemployed, with poverty and homelessness their only prospects. The remedies for repairing and reversing the intolerable social catastrophe that has resulted from the past decade's government laissez-faire of business and corporate mega-monopoly of the country are many and varied and depend upon reapplying the nation's fundamental principles with fresh interpretations. Perhaps the colonial rebels who declared independence from their mother country 2.5 and more centuries ago had their own ambitious agendas. But they revived the ancient dream of living without shackles, of determining one's own life. The most famous sentiments of the Declaration of Independence virtually shout these long-thwarted desires. Quote, that all men, though not women, and not all men either, as it turned out, are created equal, and that governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, unquote, with a little bit of a couple of adds. In other words, a democracy, a government of equals. Even the infamous Robespierre could, a few years later, define democracy as a state in which the people, as sovereign, guided by laws of its own making, does for itself all it can do, and by its delegates what it cannot. And Bill Moyers wrote two centuries later that, quote, constitutional democracy is no romantic notion. It is our defense against ourselves, the one foe that can defeat us, unquote. Yet, in contrast to the premise, a constitution manifestly provides a reasonable guarantee of political equality. Listen to a group of workers in Sheffield, England, whose bitterness in 1741 sounds as if they were speaking about life in the USA today. Quote, what's the Constitution to us if we are nothing to it? Unquote. Conceived as a republic, governed as a democracy, and always dominated by men of wealth and privilege, the USA appropriated European capitalism at the very beginning and combined it with the nascent Industrial Revolution, also imported from Europe. The American system made financial barons of a few and wage slaves of the many. The practice of democracy has been less than its publicity, not completely a sham, but all too often a facade of liberty and equality. It has been treated as a vent for the little people to whimper and perhaps exercise a slim possibility to redress inequities between privilege and repression. Redresses extremely difficult to accomplish with no little bloodshed. The real power has always been with economic elites who rule as lords in a state dominated by wealth and the unvarnished ambition to attain it. The domestic decline of the USA is primarily the responsibility of the armed might that has made it the most powerful nation on the planet, as well as in history, but at great internal cost. As more of the nation's wealth is poured into the military, the more its productivity is absorbed into serving the armed forces and profiting weapons makers, and subsequent loss of competitive position in domestic and world markets. The obsession for world power, America's self-declared manifest destiny, has given it the Pyrrhic paradox of global supremacy and internal deterioration. Although military power has been the matrix of the USA's ascendancy, opening markets abroad as well as influencing the governance of other nations, its maintenance has been at the expense of domestic priorities that, until they were debauched, act as the cultural glue holding the country together. The military-industrial mafia of interlocking corporations and the Pentagon, that one of its most favored and famous beneficiaries, General of the Armies and President of the USA, Dwight Eisenhower, warned the nation about as a not entirely cynical farewell from public life, has created a black hole into which everything is eventually drawn and disappears, such as the nation's wealth and resources, with neither replaced. And amidst the flaming testosterone of a new world order managed by the USA, the infrastructure of American society has declined, sinking deeper into unemployment and poverty. And freedom and liberty, always tenacious and unfairly distributed, and always dependent upon equality of wealth, shrivels under assault by the privileged, who mercilessly loot the nation's substance and spirit, as well as its fiscal treasure. The similarity between the world economy of the early 18th century and today's economy is starkly evident. Both periods experienced a breakdown of the open trading system, intractable international debt, German then, so-called developing world now, and rising internal debt, as well as widespread political and economic corruption. Most significant is that Americans have been hurt in both periods by a surface prosperity that concealed as well as propelled economic disaster while encouraging complacency about the national economy's underlying ills. With the end of the Cold War of the 20th century, the fall of the Soviet Union, and the eradication of communism from the major regions of the world, the exception being China, the USA rapidly moved into the power vacuum. The dramatic collapse of communist Russia in the 1990s set in motion forces that continue to change the scope and scale of world power, which are not mere strategic adjustments, but are immense historical realignments in the aftermath and vacuum of a vanished empire. This new era of Donald Trump's rhetorical New World Order, a term used by the 20th century's worst citizen, Adolf Hitler, to describe his own world vision, is an awesomely lopsided proposition in which the USA, as the last reigning superpower, excluding China for the moment, moves to impose its will economically and militarily upon the world at large. Technology and globalization in this new century millennium, the impact of centralized mega corporate power, and the cachet of techno-utopianism with concomitant ancillary technologies such as biotech, nanotech, robotics, new mass media, and the vast web of mega technologies, which includes military weaponry, are rapidly forcing the planet toward unprecedented environmental, political, and social trauma, if not complete collapse in the future. Bewildered, exhausted, and despaired by the cold realities and complexities of modern government and its unholy alliance with corporate avarice and military force, perhaps we should adhere to parsimony instead of surrender, patiently trace the confused, corrupt tentacles to their origins, and from that basic point, realizing how we got off the track of the history we intended to navigate when our ancestors declared they could no longer abide the oppressions of a king. The new world order should start at home. Neither Hitler's nor Trump's corrupt visions of worldwide supremacy, but an alternative solution to centralized planning or raw capitalism, a social industrial democracy that would reflect not only responsible policies, but also political equity, which Marxism and capitalist democracy have ultimately failed to do. And that was Return of the New World Order. And now, from the Guardian newspaper. For Trump, the message is all. No surprise he's targeting NPR and PBS. And it's written by Margaret Sullivan. It was entirely predictable that Donald Trump would go after public media in America, harming the reality-based press in every form, whether public or private, is a central part of his playbook for controlling the political narrative as he moves the country toward an authoritarian model of government. For Trump, the message is all, and anything that gets in the way should be portrayed as an evil to society and stamped out. Like every would-be autocrat, Trump has an anti-media playbook. His includes disparaging journalists, calling them the enemy of the people, suing news organizations, and tightly controlling access to newsmakers. All of that is underway in the first 3 months of Trump 2.0, as is the effort to dismantle the Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, which are funded by the U.S. federal government. Now, cue up the attack on National Public Radio and the public broadcasting system. Radical left monsters, as Trump characterized them in a social media post a few weeks ago. Then another shoe dropped. Last week, NPR itself reported that the Trump administration was drafting a memo to call for eliminating federal funds for public media. It reportedly involved a rescission, quote-unquote, the blocking of more than $1 billion that is already been approved by Congress for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which administers the federal funding for public broadcasting. The memo, in theory, would give Congress 45 days to approve the cut or keep the funding. Though the funds have already won approval, Trump is fond of acting as though his very whim will become law. His record-setting barrage of executive orders includes many that are being challenged in federal lawsuits. His entire subject, of course, is political theater at its finest. Witness, for example, the president's ever-loyal ally in Congress, the far-right Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who has helped to lead the charge against public media. "You can hate us all on your own dime," Greene insisted at a congressional hearing in March. The facts belie the theatrics to a large extent. NPR receives only about 1% of funding directly from the federal government. However, the many small member stations, and that's a quote, in communities throughout the country are much more dependent on federal money. The loss would be devastating for them and for the public, which often has no other form of news in communities that, increasingly, are becoming news deserts. And that's a quote. Congress should send Trump's plan packing and continue to provide funding, not because NPR and its member stations are perfect, not because PBS always gets it right in its overall excellent news hour program that airs each evening, but because, on balance, they are a critical part of the fact-based news ecosystem necessary to democratic self-governance. That's especially true at a time when media companies increasingly are owned by large corporations or by individual billionaires, all with their own financial agendas. Disney owns ABC News. Jeff Bezos owns The Washington Post. Warner Brothers owns CNN. Most local newspapers now are owned by big chains or by private equity companies. The Guardian, thankfully, is different. It is owned by the Scott Trust, which operates like a nonprofit, not a corporation. And that's in parentheses, by the way. Public funding, at least in theory, should provide some distance from corporate ownership by the rich and powerful. Should taxpayers really be paying for news? I think it's reasonable. Legitimate news is, after all, a key element of our democracy. And throughout Western Europe, according to a Pew Research study, public media is not only more dominant, but much more trusted than private news organizations. NPR and its member stations do a lot that is right. They correct their errors, a litmus test for legitimate news organizations. They also continue to have an ombudsman or public editor to serve as the reader's representative and to consider complaints. When I interviewed NPR's chief executive, Catherine Maher, on stage at TribeFest last year in Austin, I asked if she would commit to keeping a public editor, unlike many news organizations, including The Times and The Washington Post, which have eliminated the role. She publicly pledged to do so for as long as she is in charge. NPR also boasts many excellent journalists who are dedicated to the facts and to getting stories right. In my own area of specialization, journalism and the news industry, there is no American media reporter I respect more than David Folkenflik, whose work is characterized by energetic, unbiased reporting and frequent scoops. I was not convinced by the over-the-top complaints of the former NPR business editor, Yuri Berliner, who railed last year against his longtime employer's leftward drift. Neither was Eric Wimple of The Washington Post, who took a deep look at NPR's reporting on Trump's relationship with Russia following Berliner's broadside. Wimple's apt conclusion: NPR is no hive of lefty ideologues, as Berliner would have it, but rather is a singular news organization, one, quote, driven by old-fashioned journal principles, an aversion to offending anyone, and a steady propensity to annoy listeners, unquote. Imperfect, certainly, but just as certainly important to the overall news ecosystem and worthy of having Congress stand behind it, regardless of Trump's bullying, now and in the future. And that was for Trump. The message is all. No surprise he is targeting NPR and PBS, by Margaret Sullivan, who is a Guardian U.S. columnist. This is Michael McCusker. Jack Harris is today's engineer of this program. I suppose we Americans should feel momentous that we live in an indisputable moment of history. The absurdly ignominious reign of the preposterous Donald Trump, rich fat boy, wartime draft dodger, and persistent womanizer, who is the only convicted felon as president, whose current occupation of the White House precludes his imprisonment in the jailhouse for persistent larceny, which he can only avoid by dying in office or overthrow of the government, although he seems to be attempting seizure of the presidency in perpetuity, starting with an attempt at as a yet unconstitutional third term. Happy April showers, and I sincerely apologize for my very, very rough voice.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.